What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss.
Regular listeners of this show know that we frequently explore interpretations and nuances of abolition. When we think of abolition, we often conjure Angela Davis's articulation that prisons are a way of disappearing people and the social problems that are associated with those people. From that framing, abolition tells us to rethink the social problems being disappeared by prisons in order to address those problems as a space from which to grow, where no one person, regardless of how exceptional or not they are, is disposable. Where the social problems people have engaged with or experienced or been structured by have social solutions, as opposed to locking them away while making no real changes. On today's show, we add more layers. How embedded are these social issues in the United States? How are they not only created, but institutionalized and maintained in just about every one of our life, if not day-to-day experiences? Our guest today draws clear and direct lines between the civilizing project that was the conquest of the land that the United States is on, the genocide of indigenous peoples of this land, the institutional formation of enslavement of Black people in its both economic and social functions, and the creation and reinforcement of the idea of citizenship embedded in every one of our institutions, starting with schools and schooling, where our young folks learn about their roles, their access, and a false idea of American exceptionalism that still now binds a colonial nexus of success with whiteness and Christianity and embeds economic accumulation as the primary priority not only of our working lives, but of our very identities. We're joined now by award-winning author, scholar, cultural organizer, and poet Eve L. Ewing, who's from Chicago, now working as a professor at University of Chicago and a former middle school teacher in that city. Today, we'll be talking about her latest book, Original Sins, The Miseducation of Black and Native Children and the Construction of American Racism. Eve, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and for that generative intro. It gave me a lot to think about.
Well, your book certainly gave me a whole lot to think about, and I'm very excited to dive into it with you. We're going to get into the history and the foundational elements of what creates and reinforces racism embedded in identity in the U.S., but I'd like to bring listeners in with a personal story that you told in your book. You used to teach middle school, I think in Chicago public schools.
Yes, indeed.
And I'm wondering if you could tell the story that you described in your book from when you were a teacher of the day that your students went to jail.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. You know, there are so many day in, day out moments of being a teacher that that are easy to forget. And then those moments that stick with you forever. So one of the stories that I tell in the book is, as you said, this time when I was an eighth grade teacher, and it was my first time teaching an eighth grade homeroom. I'd been at the school for a couple of years, but I had switched roles. And I found out relatively late in the year that there was this annual tradition of taking the eighth grade students on a field trip to the jail, to Cook County Jail. You know, lots of ink has been spilled about Cook County Jail in particular, and obviously jail in general. And the thing is that the educators who planned this trip, you know, some of them were Black, some of them were not Black. All of them, I genuinely believe, cared deeply about our kids. And so I, you know, it didn't sit right with me because even though I was a lot earlier in my life and earlier in my abolitionist politic, I probably didn't have the same language that I would have now to articulate why this was a problem for me. I knew that I had certain beliefs about why people go to jail, right? And I did not believe that, you know, lack of information and this kind of like scared straight philosophy was, you know, behind who goes to jail and who doesn't. Partially based on the experiences of people in my own family that had been incarcerated. And you know, more broadly, I was asking myself this central question about like, what is our job here? What are we doing in this school? A school which served virtually 100% Black students. And then, you know, a sprinkling of other students of color. And, you know, what is the message that we're sending our students? Why do we think that our precious educational time and our few resources that we have for field trips should be spent on this? And so what I did was I devised an alternative field trip, and I, you know, told students and their families, oh, you can pick. If you want to go to the jail and do that field trip, you can do that. And if you want to come with me to see a documentary at the Gene Siskel Film Center downtown, you can go do that. It's a new poetry documentary that just came out. And, you know, half the students went to jail, half the students came with me. And I think that that moment of, you know, that a moment that I describe, that I write about, of the students who had gone to Cook County Jail, coming back, the way they walked back into my classroom, the faces that they made, some of them were weeping. That's one of those moments that I will never forget. It will stick with me forever. And so I think, you know, what's illustrative of that moment, as I reflect on it now, all these years later, isn't just like, oh, you know, these bad teachers, or, you know, the parents that sent the kids on this trip are bad parents. But more so the ways that all of us can get caught up in the assumptions, the kind of assumptions that Angela Davis is talking about, that so many abolitionist thinkers and writers talk to us about, right? The ways that carceral assumptions, punitive assumptions, can get so wound up and become part and parcel of the way we think about what we're doing, often in really insidious, really unquestioned ways, and specifically how those assumptions are deeply racialized, right? Why it is that the you know, virtually all Black class of eighth graders on the South Side of Chicago is the one where somebody's like, hey, you know, it would be great if we took these kids to jail. That's how we want to spend our precious time away from, you know, math, reading, science, and physical education and art. And so, yeah, it's one of those things that has stuck with me for a long time, and I'm grateful for the space of this project as a way to kind of unpack those connections.
And I really appreciate starting there, because it roots us in things that are happening now or very recently. We're going to go now back to some history that leads up to that. And the reason that I wanted to start there was because of how powerfully in your book you describe the connections between the creation of race in this country and the way it's intertwined with citizenship. Let's start with just the basic premise of your book. Your book is called Original Sins. In your writing, you say that this, and this is a quote, "The sin lies not only in the act of violence, but in the creation of the idea that makes the violence morally permissible." When you're talking about original sins and that violence, what are you referring to?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm not the first, and I certainly won't be the last person to draw upon this metaphor. But, you know, many writers before me have talked most often about slavery as the original sin that defines the American project. And a smaller but equally crucial number of writers and thinkers have talked about indigenous genocide, the displacement of indigenous peoples, the theft of indigenous lands, and the ongoing violence that makes that possible, as an equally, you know, original sin. And I mean that in the sense of these are kind of foundational moments in the American project. There is no United States as we have come to know it without these two acts, right? And these are ongoing acts. They're not discrete moments of, you know, where this sin is committed, but they're actually, you know, ongoing structures that come to govern the entire social, political, economic reality of the country in which we find ourselves. And so that's what I mean when I say, you know, these two original sins.
Often when we think of original sins, just like you just said, we think about conquest and genocide, and we think about the systems of slavery and the slave economy. I want us to bring in, as you did powerfully in the book, pieces that we refer to as centers of the experience of America. Thomas Jefferson is probably best known and most known, and certainly taught most in schools, for his role in writing the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
You write in your book about how he laid some of the groundwork for anti-Black and anti-Native ways of viewing the world in schools and beyond their corridors, and also talk about what it means or could mean for us to learn that history. I'm wondering if you can talk through as we're thinking about the foundational ideas of this society, of American society, what were the elements that Thomas Jefferson left us with that really articulated some of this foundational violence?
Yeah, well, as you point out, you know, most folks know Jefferson most from the Declaration of Independence, but another extremely long, extremely thorough, and extremely influential text that he wrote was the Notes on the State of Virginia. And, you know, I make an argument, and I'm excited for some historian to tell me that I'm wrong or make a counter argument, but I make an argument in the book that we can think about this as one of the first texts on race and education ever produced in the United States. And I say that because in this book, in Notes on the State of Virginia, which ultimately was which he, you know, wrote as a kind of private correspondence, which eventually was published, Jefferson lays out these a series of ideas of really of how he views the world, right? And his schema, his structure for understanding the world around him. And he's very straightforward about certain things. He's very straightforward about the idea that he believes that Black people are not capable of sophisticated thought or artistic production. You know, there's the famous quotation that he uses when talking about Phyllis Wheatley in poetry. And he says, you know, among the Blacks, there's misery enough to be sure, but no poetry, right? That this is something that Black people are categorically incapable of producing. And at the same time, he talks about the destruction and the displacement and the murder of Native peoples as kind of a tragic fait accompli. And he really talks about this as, you know, something that is unfortunate, is sad, but has to be done. It's something that has to happen. It was preordained so that the American Republic can ascend. And those two ideas, the idea that, you know, Black people are inherently subservient, are subhuman, are incapable of intelligence, and the idea that, you know, Native disappearance is a unfortunate but inevitable, you know, fact of life, fact of the world, are ideas that have really come to govern, often unquestioned, the way we think about a lot of things in American society. And alongside that, he also talked explicitly about his vision for how he thought education should work in the United States. And it's a very, what we might call a meritocratic idea. He believed in, you know, giving a certain amount of general education to everybody universally. Of course, by everybody, he means white men, white boys. Mm-hmm. And then among those, even if they were poor, even if they didn't have financial resources, he believed that those that were most talented among that pool should be kind of trained for roles in leadership and civil society. And that at the time is not the way education worked, right? There was not a public education system. And so his idea that it was for the common good of the public, if those that were most talented, regardless of their social background or whether they were aristocratic or not, should be offered the opportunity of an education at the public's expense, that was a very transgressive idea. And again, it's one that we see shaping a lot of our assumptions about the way that American society works now and the way we think about the purpose of schooling now. And so I point that out all to say that, you know, I think you know, there's lots to say about Thomas Jefferson, and lots of people have said it for many, many, many decades. But I think it's important to look at him as one of the ideological architects of, you know, how we think about schooling in the contemporary moment, and paying attention to what he thought about schools and about Black people and Native people and intelligence. And one other thing about that is he himself is very popularly understood to be like an exceptionally intelligent president, and has, you know, stands in as kind of a symbol for, you know, the sage of Monticello, you know, this kind of autodidactic, polymathic thinker, right? Who was seen as this sort of gentlemanly, scholarly figure. And so I think that that's also important for us to ask, like, what does Jefferson represent for us now? And how does that often go unquestioned in the way it relates to schools and schooling?
And as someone who was understood to be very intelligent, part of our conversation a little bit later is going to explore the question of how do we understand or define what intelligence looks like?
Yes, yes.
Before we do that, so that's Thomas Jefferson. I want to move us forward a little bit to Carl Schurz, who's the Secretary of the Interior from 1877 to 1881. This is part of the process of moving Native kids into forced boarding schools and schooling. And a quote that you quoted in your book that I pulled out from Carl Schurz, again, the Secretary of the Interior from 1877 to 1881, he said, "If the education of Indian children saves the country only one small Indian war in the future, it will save money enough to sustain 10 schools like Carlisle with 300 pupils each for 10 years. He's arguing.
He's doing the math.
Right. It's economic math, and arguing that putting Native kids into boarding schools is in the interest of the U.S. for that particular reason. I'm wondering if you can bring us into Native boarding schools and talk a bit about the Carlisle school that he's referring to in that statement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just as a side note, in Chicago where I live, there is a high school named after Carl Schurz. And so I knew the name, for a long time before I knew who the guy was. And you know, that quotation, in the kind of extended passages of in which he literally makes these dollars and cents arguments, on paper, right? Like not in secret smoke-filled rooms, but like very publicly, for the idea that the best way for the U.S. to win the quote unquote Indian War was to give up this, you know, seemingly intractable fight on the battlefield that was going to, you know, lead to all this loss of life, that had led to all this loss of life and all this bloodshed, and to just do it a simpler and cheaper way, which is to take people's kids from them, right? And that he said very forthrightly that you could accomplish this project of disappearing Native people, completing the project of manifest destiny, completing the project of land theft more efficiently if you disappear them through the assimilation of their children, through the kind of forced erasure of their children's identity, and that was just more effective. Another person who said this very explicitly was Merrill Edwards Gates, who also was a leader in the federal government over Indian affairs, as it was referred to, and who also was an educational leader. Gates was at various points, he was the president of Rutgers University. He was the president of Amherst. And so I say this to point out that, you know, these are not like fringe people, fringe thinkers. And this idea was honestly one, when I encountered a version of this quote many years ago, at this point, probably like maybe 17 years ago, 16 years ago, something like that, it really stopped me in my tracks and in many ways set me on the path to, you know, having this conversation with you all these years later, because it really made me think about how explicit a lot of these very influential leaders were in their ideology. And I think it's important for me to include these citations because, you know, when you're a Black woman writing about race, and explicitly I wrote this book where I'm just like, hey, you know, schooling at its foundation normalizes the racial hierarchy of the United States, which is, you know, predicated entirely upon the dehumanization of Black people and Native people. That's an audacious claim, right? And it's important to me that people not see me as sort of like a polemicist, right? I'm like, actually, no, these guys just, they just said the stuff in writing, like in congressional records, in letters all the time. So anyway, aside from that preamble, to answer your actual question about Carlisle, so the Carlisle Indian Industrial School was the first of what would become, you know, basically the blueprint for these quote unquote boarding schools. And I say that because I think it's important that we complicate what that means, right? And as they're known in Canada, residential schools. But Carlisle was the first of these, and it was founded by a former general named Pratt, General Pratt. And he came up with this idea actually initially when he was given charge of a group of prisoners of war. And they were prisoners of war taken from many different Native nations that were all seen as really forceful, powerful leaders, people that were really effectively leading resistance against the U.S. government. And so he was this really accomplished military leader, and they gave him these prisoners of war, thinking, you know, if we that they were kind of like high value targets, right? And that this accomplished general would be the one to take them away, and that would sort of crumble some of the resistance that was happening in their various communities against the U.S. military. And Pratt had this idea. He took these prisoners into Florida, and he had this idea eventually that, you know, for your listeners who read a lot of abolitionist thought or read Foucault or, you know, just have experienced like the carceral state in different ways, he realized, hey, you know, we don't need to lock them up. We don't need to, you know, keep them behind lock and key and have guards posted outside all the time. If we instead get them to police each other, if we instead
instead get them to become, you know, the prison guards of their own prison. And so he set up this project of gradually, you know, quote unquote, civilizing the men that were in his charge, and putting them on patrol, giving them surplus military uniforms until, you know, reminiscent of some of the most sort of sadistic prison experiments that we've seen both in real life and in, you know, psychological settings over the course of the 20th century, he basically turned the space that they were in into a hybrid military camp slash school slash prison. And he enlisted local educators, local white women educators to come in and teach the men. And so by the time he was done with this social experiment, he realized that he had sort of struck gold. And he said, you know, I'm going to defeat the native menace with what he called an army of school teachers, right? I'm going to use this idea of taking Native people away from their barbaric settings and making sure that they are as far away from, you know, Native culture, Native life as possible, and instead isolating them among white culture and using these kind of forceful tactics to assimilate them. And that's how we're going to win this war. And he realized that, you know, as effective as it had been with grown adults that were his prisoners, that the most effective way to do this would be by taking people's children. And so that's where Carlisle was born. And it really became, you know, I think I'm really moved and inspired to see that I think compared to 15 years ago, so many more people are aware of these schools than used to be. But I think it's really important to talk about the many different forms of violence that were taking place there. So, you know, one very obvious and important one is essentially kidnapping people's children by force, right? And when they got to these schools, kids were kept away from their families. They were forbidden from speaking their languages. They were forbidden from their, you know, engaging in their faith practices. They were forced to cut their hair. They were often, you know, sexually abused, physically abused, verbally abused. And on top of all that, eventually it became, you know, mandated by law that their parents had to send their kids away. And so there were parents that faced incarceration, face the withholding of rations or other forms of starvation if they tried to resist. There were kids that died trying to escape these schools, right? Trying to run away. And those forms of violence are just so novel or innovative, right? In one of the ways that the American project has these new forms of evil, right? It's not enough to take somebody's children away from them. It's not enough to say, we're going to lock you up if you try to get your children back. But when those children are in your care, right, to harm them, to, as Pratt famously said, dedicate yourself to killing the Indian in them so that you could, quote unquote, save the child. And then to call that a school, right? I think it's really important for us to understand the cultural influence of these places. And one other thing that I'll say, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, we understand that slavery and the slave economy was not just something that the South benefited from, right? We understand that when enslaved people were picking cotton in the South, that there's the entire textile industry and mill industry in the North that benefits from that, right? And similarly, when these kids were taken away, one of the things that Pratt created was what he called the outing system. And the outing system was that he would actually place these kids as domestic laborers in the homes of white families, and eventually in also industrial settings, agricultural settings. And this became a hallmark of, you know, many Native boarding schools across the United States, that kids would be taken away from the actual school and placed in the private residences of white folks, or sometimes on farms and orchards, you know, doing this backbreaking labor. And so, you know, when we say that this is, that the country is built on this violence, that is, you know, I'm a poet, but that is not merely a metaphor. That is, I mean that in the literal sense. So yeah, that's a little bit of the background. And I think that there's a lot of contention around when these practices even ended, and continues to be a lot of truth and reconciliation and really horrific fact-finding about understanding the true extent of the way that children and multiple generations of families have been harmed by this. And I really encourage folks, if they haven't, to check out the documentary Sugarcane, which is about this and in the Canadian context, but is really heartrending, but also really informative, and was co-directed by a friend of mine, Julian Brave Noisecat. So people should check that out if they want to learn more about it. But yeah, it's truly a devastating part of our history that has contemporary implications.
Earlier, you mentioned and you named out loud something that I think needs to be reiterated, that the points you're making here are not only analytical connections and analytical jumps. It's quite literally the actual history. And in the book that I read, it's just done very powerfully. I'm trying to also imagine for listeners who, of course, likely have not read the book, how do you draw the line from the establishment of these native boarding schools? And I think most modern folks who are progressive in our society can look back on these schools as horrible institutions. How do you draw the line from those schools to the idea of schooling and the creation of citizenship as we know it today? I'm thinking about, for example, the institutionalization and the creation of the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah, what a crazy story.
You also mentioned that in Chicago, there's even a school currently named after Carl Schurz, who was one of the masterminds behind those native boarding schools you just described. So there are these material connections that one could look if we can get past just the names. But yeah, how do you draw the line from the establishment? Okay, we can look back and say, okay, those native boarding schools, terrible, horrific treatment of indigenous peoples on these lands, and of course, connected to the genocide and land grab. But that was so long ago.
Right. I mean, you know, one thing in the context of the United States, nothing is long ago, right? And it's always important to remember that. And I think that, you know, a question that I begin the book with, and a question that I begin a lot of my, you know, my classes with when I teach students about the history of schooling and the contemporary role of schooling in our society, is like, what are schools for? Like, what are we doing in school? What are we asking kids to do? Why are we asking that of them? What are we asking families to do? Why are we asking that of them? And I think as it pertains to Black children, Native children, not exclusively those children, but I think that, you know, this is part of the important ideological foundation of the schooling project. It really goes back to, in many ways, the way we started our conversation with thinking about the jail, right? Which is that we have these assumptions about discipline, about punishment, about control, about social control, about subservience, about one's role in the economic order, that go by and large unquestioned by many people, including, you know, many people of goodwill, many people who care for children. And there are ways in the kind of everyday machinations of what happens in a school building, everything from, you know, the assumption that we're going to separate kids by age instead of having opportunities for intergenerational learning, right? That we're going to keep, you know, elders and community members out of the building, right? That schooling is not a place where we have these opportunities for kind of porous boundaries between who is a teacher and who is a learner. The assumption that this is something that has to happen in a building as opposed to like learning outside and learning from the more than human world and our more than human relatives and the lands and waters. Assumptions about how students ought to walk, how they ought to talk, what they ought to wear, where they ought to sit, the fact of them sitting, right? A friend of mine talked to me the other day about child's teacher citing the child for standing up casually next to his desk and, you know, complaining to the parent and saying, whatever you're doing isn't working, right? And myself, having been a teacher, I found myself often having to really ask these questions, right? Like, if this kid works better or thinks better or feels better if they are standing next to their desk or standing at their desk working, and they are doing things that otherwise seem beneficial to them and to the classroom community, does it matter that they're not sitting down, right? And so much about what happens in schooling is like the assumption that this is a place where you have to learn how to sit down, right? As a professor, I have a very nice standing desk, adaptable standing desk that, you know, my department paid for. It has all these nice preset buttons that allow me to choose, you know, like when I want to stand, when I want to sit, I press a button. And it's understood that, you know, because my thinking work is so important, that I should have whatever kind of standing or sitting arrangement works for me. Well, why don't we extend that grace to the youngest people among us, right? And to the young people that are most learning how to navigate themselves, the world, and their community. And so I think that when it comes to Native kids, when it comes to Black kids, that is when we all of a sudden have these often very, very strict, very punitive, very surveillance-oriented notions about what ought to happen in a schooling space that I think is deeply rooted, not only in the history of the schools themselves, but in the history of the way that the state has needed to view our communities, our bodies, our children, in order to justify its own existence, right? If you are going to have a country where you say that it is okay and fine for some people to be property, and you need those people to also believe that that is fine so that they do not engage in violent uprising or revolution, or in the Reconstruction era that they don't engage in, you know, projects of righteous vengeance, you need a system that tells not only them, but everybody around them that that is fine. Right? That subservience is normal and natural. If you are going to have a country that is founded upon the theft and murder of, you know, the land and the people that were stewards of this place since time immemorial, you need to have a system that tells them and tells everybody around you that that disappearance is normal and necessary, right? And so it's partially about the structures of the schools themselves and their legacies, which again are very, very, very recent history. You know, and I know folks who attended different iterations, you know, people that are not that much older than me that attended different iterations of these schools, whose parents attended different iterations of these schools. And so, you know, that is very recent history. But more broadly, it's about the ways that we internalize our ideas about, like, what are we actually doing and why are we doing it? And so much of that goes back to these assumptions of subhumanity that I think have these deep and insidious historical roots.
For folks just tuning in, we are in conversation with Eve L. Ewing about her latest book, Original Sins, The Miseducation of Black and Native Children and the Construction of American Racism. Eve, before we get to the three pillars of American racism that are cultivated in our institutions of schooling that you described in the book, I'm wondering if you can first ground us in the Pledge of Allegiance. It's something that many kids in schools are told to say every morning. And it relates to the project of nationalizing an identity that is normalized amongst all kids, that is also rooted in civilizational and conquest efforts.
Yeah, I think, you know, I kind of chuckled when we first brought it up because it's one of those things that once you dig into it, you're like, this is just bizarre, right? And absolutely. If you were an alien and you landed in a classroom, you'd be like, what is happening? Like, why are people doing this? And I include the story about the Pledge of Allegiance in the book, partially because even though it's not the main thrust of what I'm talking about, it's also important for me that folks understand that the creation of whiteness, that the creation of white citizenship, white citizenry as a concept, is also like a racializing project, right? And that it's not like, I think often the way we talk about race in the United States, the identity of whiteness enjoys a kind of like racelessness. But I think it's actually really instructive just from a sociological and historical perspective to understand the way that whiteness was itself constructed and created. And so the Pledge of Allegiance was a huge part of the way that schools engaged in this project. And, you know, it's funny the ways that Nell Irvin Painter, the historian, talks about, you know, these different waves of what she calls the expansion of whiteness. And so at the founding of you know, what we now know as the Republic of the United States, you know, there are very limited ideas of who could be white, right? It's basically like Anglo-Saxon people. And, you know, we know many, many folks are familiar with the history of, right, the arrival of Irish immigrants and less often talked about, but equally important to the history of this country, German immigrants, who at the time that they were arriving were very much not seen as white. we're seen as, you know, a problem. We're seen as a problem in the ways that many subsequent waves of immigrants have been seen as a problem. There's this quotation I include from Benjamin Franklin, who was like complaining that there are too many Germans in Pennsylvania, and there are so many Germans that soon it would be impossible to just walk around speaking English, that everybody was going to have to learn German. This is a huge problem, right? And there were physical fights, riots, legislative fights over the role that Irish people and Irish families and Irish immigrants would play in the schooling system at the time when they were first arriving in the United States, because there were Irish parents that were like, why am I going to send my kid to a public school where they're going to get there and people are going to say awful things about Catholics, right? Where my kids are degraded, where the curriculum degrades them, right? And doesn't treat them well. And so that was a huge, like massive contentious issue. And so, you know, that is a history that I think folks are not always familiar with, the ways that this question of who gets to be white is kind of battled over in schools. And then towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, we saw this new wave of immigrants that was by and large from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe. And when the new immigrants came, all of a sudden people were like, oh no, we've always loved the German and the Irish folks. Like, they're cool. They're white people. Like, they're good. But these new people, we don't like them, right? We don't like the Italians. We don't like the Eastern Europeans, who are, you know, in many cases Jewish. There's a wave of anti-Semitism that also goes along with that. And so amidst this, the idea of the Pledge of Allegiance was very intentionally to create this sense of a cohesive white American identity in the classroom, and to explicitly, again, in the same way that, you know, Schurz and Gates understood that children are often the most vulnerable and some of the most, you know, as they saw it, easily influenced members of our society because they often don't have social power. They saw this idea of the Pledge of Allegiance as, you know, an opportunity to tell kids at a very young age, very explicitly, your fidelity and your loyalty should not be to, you know, whatever Bolshevik country you came from. It should be to this country, right? And now that you are here, you are an American, you owe loyalty to America. And it was, you know, that was kind of the origins of it. And it was coupled at the same time with the creation and the proliferation of a lot of other institutions that we now kind of take for granted as part of the fabric of schooling. But for example, things like recess and playground games, there was a whole literature, a whole theory and philosophy that, again, was, you know, scrupulously documented in writing, in speeches, in journal articles that said, you know, we need to have kids play games at recess and we need to have them play structured games so that they learn that they are white, that they learn that they are American, that they forget that they're Italian, that they forget that they're Jewish. And even the creation of school lunch programs also, you know, partially serve this social purpose. The idea that we need to teach kids, you know, to eat bland New England American food, right? And not all these like sinful spices and garlics that their parents are teaching them to eat. And so there are all these things that we kind of take for granted, and again, don't often ask, like, where did this come from? Why are we doing this? That take place in schools, that I think it's important for, you know, white folks to realize that this socialization, this creation of these ideas has also affected them, right? And shapes the very notion of what we think of as white American identity into the present.
Again, we're in conversation with Eve Ewing about her latest book, Original Sins, The Miseducation of Black and Native Children and the Construction of American Racism. Eve, I have to make an admission that I have so many questions and things that I want to talk
well,
to you about.
Well, you didn't
in
know that I take 20 minutes to answer every question either. So that's on me.
Your book is so juicy and I am grateful for it. And I'm truly hoping that we have time at the end of the conversation to talk a little bit about education for decolonization. But before we get there, you describe in the book three pillars of American racism that are cultivated in our institutions of schooling. You write, quote, "Our schools not only reflect these values from the broader society in which they're situated, but actually play an active role in constructing, normalizing, and upholding them." The three pillars that you describe are the premise of intellectual inferiority, the premise of discipline and punishment, and the premise of economic subjugation. Now, I'm hoping we can maybe somewhat briefly, but dive into each of those. I'd like to start with the premise of intellectual inferiority and how it's cultivated in our institutions of schooling. How does it impact how we think about intelligence itself and about how science grows and builds on itself to create something new that perhaps isn't actually new.
I'll say it as plainly as I can. I think that a lot of people in the United States inherently believe that Black people and Native people are less intelligent, constitutionally, innately less intelligent and less capable of sophisticated thought. And I think that that's like a really uncomfortable thing to say, but it plays out in a lot of assumptions and a lot of the ways that our schools function, everything from tracking to the way we think about standardized testing to the conversations that are happening now about, you know, quote unquote DEI, right? And there is an implicit assumption that if there is a Black person in a particular professional role or leadership role, that they cannot possibly be more deserving than the, you know, white person next to them. And so I think that, and, you know, this is disturbingly enough, a presumption that in some of the survey data from things like the General Social Survey that I cite in the book, that people like out and out say, right, that they're, this is a thing that many people still believe. One of the examples that I give is, you know, every year there are a certain number of questions on the SAT that are there for norming purposes. So they're kind of like pilot questions. They're like beta test questions. And the ideal question, as the framers of this test see it, if you put a question on the SAT and you map out who got it right and who got it wrong, you want to see roughly like a bell curve, right? Like it should be like a lot of people, you know, some people got it wrong, some people got it right. And, you know, you want it to be like not too hard, not too easy. And there are some scholars who've done some analysis of past questions on the SAT and found that when a question is, for whatever random reason of statistical happenstance, found to be a question that more white students do better on, it will be kept in the test. And if it is a question that more Black students through random statistical happenstance do better on, that is seen as like a problem, right? Like the question is broken. And when people read that, they feel very shocked by it. When I talk about it in, you know, like book events, people feel very shocked by it. But when I've had conversations with educators in doing these book tour events, I've asked people flat out, like, if you sat down in a school-wide meeting and you looked at all of your school, your students' test scores, right, and you saw that the students of color were all doing really well at something and all the white students were failing, right, like, what would your response be to that? Would you feel like, oh, something weird is happening, versus how do you feel when the inverse is true, right? And what are the ways that even some of our conversations about, yeah, awkward, right?
Yes.
Super awkward. What are some of the ways that our conversations about the achievement gap are predicated upon this kind of normalization? I even had to throw in for the football fans, you know, one example from the NFL, which is that when we saw these class action lawsuits over things like CTE and, you know, permanent cognitive damage that football players face from, you know, getting concussed over and over on the football field. And there are people who actually have to put a price on paying out families for the damages caused. They assigned less monetary worth to the cognitive value of Black people, right? This is like all within the last decade. And so there are all these examples that I think are really worth thinking about. And I think it's important to, you know, go back to the quotation that you read, to think like schools are, you know, when you wake up in the morning and you walk into a school that is facing challenges, it can feel incredibly overwhelming. And sometimes it's easy for us to say like, well, you know, schools are simply a mirror to a broken society, to an unjust society. And, you know, what can we really do? Because until our nation gets better, we can never expect our schools to get better. But I think it's important to recognize like schools aren't just sitting by the sidelines, right? That schools are actually a laboratory where some of these ideas get honed and perfected and normalized literally from the time we are little babies, you know? And so I think that that is a distressing idea, but we can also think of it as an empowering idea, because really what I'm hoping is that, you know, educators and parents and community members and young people, students and activists who read this book will ask themselves like, okay, what are some of the minute ways in which this is playing out in our space, in our community, right? And what can we do to change it? What can we do to make things a little bit different? Yeah. So that's one of, that's one of the pillars, but that's a question that I hope people ask. I mean, you and I talked a little bit already, I think, about, the second idea, which is discipline and punishment, right? We've talked about quite a bit, and economic subservience, I feel like we've talked about a little bit as well. But you know, there are obviously way more than three, but you know, when you write a book, you got to pick stuff and stick to it. So those are the three that the book really is structured around.
Well, we have talked about them a little bit. I do want to touch on them a little bit more because your book really hit me like a ton of bricks on those sections. So in terms of the premise of discipline and punishment and how it's cultivated in school institutions, I'm wondering if you can just touch for a moment on the ways that schools turn bodily control into a power dynamic in the school that then, of course, I was going to say bleeds out, but that's not the correct term, leads kids out into the world beyond the school site.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the phrases in education research that has, you know, probably been the most successful in moving into the popular discourse in the last several years is the idea of the school to prison pipeline, right? And the idea of the school to prison pipeline is that there are things that happen in schools that shuttle some kids into the formal criminal legal system, right? Kids getting suspended in schools, leading to expulsion, leading to arrest, police officers being physically present in schools, doing things like pat downs, right? Metal detectors in schools. Certainly the example I gave were literally taking kids into a jail, right? And so there are these kind of formal ways in which there are kids who end up incarcerated, and that journey begins in schools. And, you know, I've been very, very fortunate that one of the early education policy courses that I taught in my my career as a professor was at Stateville Correctional Center, which is a maximum security prison in Illinois. And I co-taught with a good friend and colleague who I also quote extensively in the book, Dave Stovall. And, you know, so that prison, most of our students were, you know, they're in there for very long or life sentences. So many of them were quite on in years, right? Like in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And it's amazing to me how many of them, you know, recalled in these very vivid ways the thing that teacher said to them, right? That time that adult in school didn't believe them, the time that they had that fight, right? That time that they got expelled, and the ways that they traced, you know, their lives and where they found themselves back to these schooling experiences. And at the same time, one of the most valuable things that I feel like I've learned in the past several years from many scholars who are folks who study and think about carcerality in schools and think about abolition is this idea of what some have called the school-prison nexus, most notably Erica Miners that I cite extensively. And the idea of the school-prison nexus is that even if it's only a minority of kids that actually enter that pipeline, right, that actually get arrested, that actually end up in jail or incarcerated otherwise, that there are ways in which the logics of the prison, which again are the logics of surveillance, the logics of bodily control, are so normalized in schooling spaces, right? And we see extreme versions of this certainly in the news when we hear about, you know, what are referred to as no excuses charter schools, right? Schools where it's very, 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 very important that students do things like sit in silence during lunch, or in some cases, you know, earn their desks, right? This is a real example that my colleague Joanne Golan writes about in a book she wrote called Scripting the Moves. She did an extended ethnography in a school where students came in and had to sit on the floor, and only through, you know, proving themselves could they earn a desk. If they were seen to have misbehaved, and misbehavior in this case includes things like daydreaming, tapping on the desk, not keeping your eyes on the speaker or tracking the speaker, that they would be what was known as benched, which would mean that you would have to wear kind of like a ugly shirt on top of your uniform shirt, and nobody is allowed to talk to you for the rest of the day. And if they do, they can also be quote unquote benched, right? And so these are just really sadistic practices that are often done in schools where, and this is also where we get into the labor issues, right? Where these are often done in schools where there are not union agreements for the teachers, because oftentimes one of the ways that we have permissible charter law is that you don't have to abide by union agreements. And so because of that, oftentimes the folks that are working there are very, very brand new, very inexperienced teachers who themselves are being told, like, this is what's good for these kids, right? And if you care about these kids, this is what you're going to do. And again, just like the, you know, psych experiments that you learn about in school, it is unfortunately often very easy to get people to be conscripted into these regimes of control, even if they profess to care about the children. And so, you know, those are some of the extreme examples, but we see this again in so many, you know, when I walk into some of these schools, as a visitor, as an observer, as an educator myself, and I see some of these rules about uniforms, about belts, about, you know, how long your hair can be or not be, about, you know, how you're supposed to move, walk, talk, you know, in some cases, like, how you can use the bathroom and when you can use the bathroom. I think about the wild disparity between that and what I see in, you know, often very elite private schools, where students are encouraged as much as possible to use their imaginations and be free and move their bodies and explore, right? And I have to ask the question, why is that what's seen as necessary for some kids and not other kids? And so, yeah, I think that that's, it's something that really often goes unquestioned as it pertains to certain kids and certain types of bodies. And it prepares us for, you know, the world where when somebody is murdered extrajudicially by the police, the first question that people ask is, you know, why was he resisting, right? Or what was he doing? Or why didn't he comply, right? And so those ideas of compliance, listening, obedience, and that whatever happens to you after you don't comply, you deserve, I see as intimately tied with this kind of ideology that we see as being normalized in schools.
Eve, we're going to have to wrap it up. And I am going to close with one last question. I really have literally 25 more questions to go through, and I would love to chop it up with you another time. But you wrote at the beginning of your final chapter that that part of your book is the one you were both looking forward to writing the most and also the most challenged by, because you knew that by the time a reader gets through 250 pages of challenging social and political right. history that makes us rethink parts of our daily lives, our childhood, our parenting, or for those of us who work in schools, our jobs, that we would be looking to you to wrap it up with something clean, something like, and here's what to do differently.
Right, right. Here's my 10 easy steps for how to de-racist your school.
I'll certainly be tuned in for your next book. That's the 10 easy steps. But I know you use abolition as a political framework that is powerful and important to you. And I'm wondering if you were to put yourself in your own shoes from where we started this conversation, when you were a middle school teacher and your students had a field trip to jail, how would you use your knowledge now to inform how you would think about engaging with either your school site or the kids themselves or the families around challenging that framework?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that is always possible that doesn't cost us money, right? Sometimes it can cost us other things, but we always have the possibility of asking questions. And I think that the way I approached my time as a middle school teacher, and part of, you know, what it means to be engaging with young people at this incredibly precious time in their lives where they're undergoing this rapid transformation in terms of the way they see themselves and the role they play in the world. And so much of that is about asking questions, right? And that's also the way I approach my time now, you know, teaching students that are a little bit older. although, you know, as I get older and older, they feel younger and younger to me. But I think that what I would have liked to do, and what I invite people who are engaging with this book and with these conversations to do, is to just begin by asking those questions, right? Like, what do we hope to accomplish from this? Why is that important to us? What are our values? Are the choices that we are making in this instance aligned with those values? And making space for that practice of question asking to not be scary or accusatory, or, you know, painting a intractable brush over who's right and who's wrong and who's good and who's bad. But, you know, just actually asking questions. And I think one of my favorite memories from teaching middle school is I had a day where my students just came into class and they were really frustrated. And they were frustrated because of something that an adult had said to them. They had been, you know, they had been accused of kind of misbehavior in another class. And an adult had said something like, you know, this may be okay for you to do at home, but it's not okay here. And one of my students said something like, okay, you know, we can be wrong, but like, why do you have to say bad stuff about our families? Like, why does it have to be, oh, okay, about what we do at home? Like, yeah. What's that about? And they were just really mad. And I set aside, and I think like anger is a righteous part of being a human, right? And so I set aside what I had planned for that day. And I, you know, I just said like, what would you like in terms of how you want to be treated by adults in this building? And really probing them in questions, you know, not just like everybody should be nice to me all the time, but pushing back like, okay, what if somebody does something that hurts somebody else's feelings? Or what if somebody does something that's dangerous? Or, you know, why do you think this person is using this language or talking to you in this way? And it was just one of the most revelatory and important conversations I ever remember having. And I would be willing to bet I'm lucky enough to be in touch with, you know, some of those students all these years later, some of whom are parents themselves. And those are the kinds of conversations that they remember. And so I think, you know, what I would have liked to have done would be to model that it doesn't have to be scary to ask questions. And when we practice that, we can find ourselves making space to move a little bit closer to the people that we're trying to be and to the purpose that we're trying to enact in this this wild project that we've created called school.
Well, on that note of abolition in practice, Eve, we're going to have to end the conversation there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the incredibly thoughtful questions. I really appreciate it.
It was my honor. That's the voice of award-winning author, scholar, cultural organizer, and poet Eve L. Ewing, who's from Chicago, now working as a professor at University of Chicago and a former middle school teacher in that city. We were in conversation about her latest book, Original Sins, The Miseducation of Black and Native Children and the Construction of American Racism. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media. That's at lawanddis, D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law and Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA Radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.